You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. I hope you had a nice holiday weekend. Here's a question for you. Are you getting a little sick of the Thanksgiving leftovers? You know, every year around the holidays, Americans cook and cook, and they eat and eat, but then many end up throwing out a lot of that extra food. And yet there are so many folks who don't have enough food. The period between Thanksgiving and New Year's, besides being the most wonderful time of the year, is also when we throw away the most garbage. Every year, California businesses and consumers toss out nearly 6 million tons of food. And when all that food gets trucked and dumped into landfills, it can turn into methane, which is a greenhouse gas dozens of times more damaging to the climate than carbon dioxide. So to both help save the planet and feed more people, the state of California, along with hunger relief groups, are trying to find better ways to rescue and recycle food, often perfectly edible food, before it's tossed into the trash. Today, Saul Gonzalez, host of KQED's The California Report, has more.
To learn more, one early morning, I visited a big industrial building south of downtown LA, where forklifts were unloading pallets of pretty fantastic-looking fruits and vegetables from truck after truck that pulled in.
What you're seeing is a 10,000-square-foot warehouse, which is pretty much literally the pit stop for hundreds of thousands of pounds of fresh produce that we're recovering every single day.
That's Rick Namias, the founder of Food Forward. It's a nonprofit that accepts excess fruits and vegetables from food wholesalers and farmers who frequently have way too much produce to ever sell it for a profit. Food Forward then repackages the food and donates it to local hunger relief groups. If this wasn't done, perfectly good food would end up in landfills and turn into methane.
It's shameful, it's wrong, and we are existing to take what they call that shrink, that stuff they can't sell, or that would flood the market and bring the prices down, getting it to where it's needed.
I see where it's needed a few miles north of the Food Forward warehouse at a weekly food distribution event for residents of LA's Pico Union District. Produce that would have been thrown out in the past is bagged by volunteers in a parking lot and then given out to residents of this working class and largely immigrant neighborhood whose food insecurity has been made worse by COVID.
Today we have a medley of things like asparagus, cherries, oranges, plums, bell peppers.
That's Erica Nieves, a coordinator for Seeds of Hope, the nonprofit that manages the program.
We bag about 1,000 bags of fruits and vegetables every Friday. And really what we like to do is we like to give families that come by whatever it is that they need, as much as they need. For us, it's a blessing not letting food go to waste.
Food recycling in California got a big boost in 2016 when a state law went into effect requiring businesses to start reducing their organic refuse. And next year, California will take its war on food waste to a new place, your home. Starting in January, Californians will be required to recycle their residential organic waste, including food scraps. Instead of tossing old or unused produce into the garbage, food will have to be put in organic waste disposal bins provided by local governments. The food waste will then go to recycling centers where it's supposed to be turned into either usable compost or biofuels.
So we are working with all of the local governments in California to institute programs so that we can get organic waste out of landfills and either compost it or, as we're doing here today, find even better next uses for things that would have otherwise been thrown away.
That's Rachel Wagner, the director of Cal Recycle, California's recycling department.
We're looking for individual Californians to think about their relationship with their food.
She says that the state is to effectively fight climate change. Food recycling must become part of every Californian's daily life.
Rather than throw that banana peel in the garbage can where it's going to break down to methane in a landfill, throw it in your compost pile or in your yard waste bin. And this is the single easiest thing that we can do as Californians to impact climate change.
In all, the state of California hopes to slash the amount of organic waste going to landfills, including food, by 75% by the end of 2025. For Greater LA, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
The following program is brought to you in living color on NBC.
Frank Cruz was an associate professor at Cal State Long Beach when he made his television debut and in turn changed the entire course of his professional career. The show was called Chicano 1 and 2, the Mexican-American Heritage Series, and Cruz was its host. It first aired 50 years ago, back in July of 1971. It featured several of California's first Chicano studies professors who would examine history from the Chicano perspective and discuss contemporary issues facing the Mexican-American community. Well, the program reran once in 1972, and then the film reels were put to bed in Cruz's garage until 3 months ago when he decided to see if they could be brought back to life. Well, thanks to an archivist at the USC Hugh M. Hefner Moving Image Archive, 9 episodes of the series are once again available for you to check out. And Frank Cruz, host of the series, co-founder of Telemundo, the Spanish-language TV network, joins us to talk about it. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Steve.
And also with us is Natalia Molina, a distinguished professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, and the author of the forthcoming book, A Place at the Nayarit, How a Mexican Restaurant Nourished a Community. Hi, Natalia.
Hi, Steve. Happy to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you both. Frank, I'll start with you. This series first aired in 1971. I mean, paint us a little picture of what was going on during that time here in Greater LA.
Well, the 1960s were quite a tumultuous period of time historically for us in this country. You had the Voting Rights Act, you had the Civil Rights Act, women were gaining equality, and you had, specifically in the East LA area, the high school walkouts of 1968, and then, of course, shortly thereafter, the killing of Rubén Salazar. So it was quite a period of very historical significance and turmoil in the sense that Chicanos and other minority groups in this country were asserting themselves in a variety of ways.
This was around the time of the Chicano moratorium, Boyle Heights. You mentioned Salazar, of course, who was killed in that coffee shop, right, by the sheriff's deputies outside.
Correct.
Yeah. What kind of responses, Frank, did you get when the series first aired? I mean, did it gain any traction at first? It aired at this really odd time slot, right? Like on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, it was what television networks and radio networks across the country call, you know, public interest service obligation period of time that they devote to community affairs and interests. And basically, that's what it was. However, the significant thing of it, of the series, was that it really marked the first time ever in the history of the United States that a commercial network, in this case, NBC, produced a series on people of color in the United States. I know the time slot at the time was not that favorable, of course, for maximum audience, but I think it was significant in that sense that never before had a commercial network ever done that. And by the way, it preceded Roots, by the way, by about 7 or 8 years.
Wow. Natalia, you told the LA Times that the series was cutting edge then, and unfortunately cutting edge now. Those are your words. What did you mean, unfortunately cutting edge now?
Well, what we see is that Latinos represent almost 1 in every 5 Americans, yet they're vastly represented in so many sectors, elected office, journalism, but even in how we represent them on screen. And so this was an opportunity to see Latinos living three-dimensional lives, seeing their contributions to society, both long-term, you know, because he goes back to looking at the history in Mexico, to immigration, to their contributions today, as well as the people that were invited to speak on these topics. These were the leaders at the time in education, in politics, in labor rights. And so we were introduced to some of the leading figures of the time, along with understanding the history.
You're a professor, as I mentioned, in the field of American studies and ethnicity. How do you think, Natalia, this series might make its way into your classroom, or maybe change the scope of your field and others like it?
I'm happy to say that in that area, we have made progress. Not as much as we would like, but there are many more monographs, texts, documentaries on Latinos today. That being said, I think that this documentary series doesn't just contribute to the zeitgeist of the time. You know, it really does capture so many of the important topics going on, but it can also serve as a primary source. It can also serve as a baseline. Where were we and where have we gone to today? How far have we come today in terms of representing Latinos? I think that when different media companies, everybody celebrates Hispanic Heritage Month and they want to say, look what we've contributed to Latino history, that they can even, use this series as a kind of baseline to say, are we contributing more than this series has? Have we put out alternate images? Do we have more people represented in our companies? I think there's lots of ways to use it both inside and outside of the classroom, especially today when we talk about the importance of public history and civic memory. Lately we've been talking so much about the importance of statues, commemorations, murals, and this documentary series was a way of educating the public.
I want to play a snippet of one of the episodes from a much younger Frank Cruz. It's about how schools should approach teaching Mexican and Mexican-American students. Again, this is from 1971.
Today, education is changing for the little brown boy. No longer will Spanish-speaking children be classified as mentally or educationally retarded simply because our educational systems, as they now stand, are unable to cope with the bilingual, bicultural needs of the communities they allegedly serve. Primary education in our school systems is one of the major stumbling blocks for the Chicano child today. Quo vadis, America, is a question asked by Chicano educators and college students.
Quo vadis, it's a Latin phrase. It means where are you marching, or specifically where are you going, right? And
right.
At that time, Frank, in 1971, where was education going? I mean, why did it take so long to pay attention to Chicano children in school and the difficulties they were having?
Well, I think you've got to go back at and look at the history of what prompted the educational problems that we had in those days. The school system and the curriculum wasn't really developed for success for a Hispanic child. For example, eighth graders and 11th graders across the country are taught about immigration to the United States. And usually the textbooks at those years will talk about Irish immigration, Italian immigration, Jewish immigration, and all of the different immigrant groups that came to the United States. But you didn't have it with the Hispanic child. And that, when I was teaching at Lincoln High School at the time in 1967 and 68, I mean, I could see that. And here I had before me a class of 99.9% Hispanic children who didn't know about how their ancestors came to the United States. If anything, one could argue that historically Latinos were, made to look inferior. And I think the series highlighted a lot of that, that we attempted to attack, if you will, a lot of the myths that existed back then in those days that hurt the child in an educational sense. I think that's what we were trying to show, that the curriculum and the coursework and all of the attention to the educational needs of a Hispanic child needed to drastically change. And we tried to show in the series that the harm that it was doing to children.
Natalia, was that a question of assimilation, do you think? I mean, for such a long time, that has been arguably the model of America, that this great melting pot was successful, Because everybody, no matter their roots, you know, and you heard Frank mention Italian and other ethnic groups, Irish, and coming from other places, you know, assimilated to this country. What was different, do you think, in Chicano communities? Or was it different only in how it responded to that model?
Part of it was an impulse to assimilate, that if the students spoke in English, lost their Spanish language, that it would help them assimilate. But part of it was just not valuing the culture and valuing the history. So we also see the ways in which, besides assimilation tactics, those students were tracked into certain classes and that their communities were not valued. Part of not valuing that community was not including them in the textbooks, not teaching them their history. And even to this day, when I ask my students, when they take my Latinx studies classes, why they're there, the first thing they say is they want to know their history. And not only do they learn this history, but they take it home to their families. If I ask them to do a oral interview, to visit a museum, to watch a documentary like Chicano 1 and 2, they will watch it with their families. One of the silver linings of the pandemic was that our students were learning at home, and their parents sometimes came to their classrooms because they didn't get to learn this history. Even our best educated students don't know this history because it is still not readily taught in schools or represented in museums, public programming, or film and television.
Frank, I want to wrap things up by playing your outro. This is from episode 10 of the series about Chicano stereotypes in mass media. Let's listen.
The Chicano will not be denied his dignity and pride. He is no longer a voiceless, anonymous minority. He is now gaining expression and is preparing to write these chapters necessary to the history of the Southwest. His cultural influence is being revived and infused with greater meaning and vigor.
50 years since you said that, Frank. Do you think history has been more successfully revised since? I mean, with fewer stereotypes, more accuracy, or are we not there?
Well, we're not there completely, because it's still a major problem. I often think of, to use the old African adage, until the lion learns how to write, tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. History is still being written by non-Hispanics. And I think we need to write it. I think we were attempting to open the door in those days so that others could follow and see the changes and bring about those changes that were dramatically needed in those days and still are to this day. And, you know, professors like Natalia Molina, I think, and others, with the growth of Chicano studies and ethnic studies across the country, I think it's an effort to change that. But there have been some changes, and I think, in just take for example, in those days there were no Chicano studies departments. They were created almost overnight in the late 60s, early 70s. It takes a lot of work and a lot of scholarly activity and work at all levels in order to bring about those changes to make history relevant.
Frank Cruz, host of Chicano 1 and 2, the Mexican-American Heritage Series, and Natalia Molina, a distinguished professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. I want to thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You can find the series, by the way, on the USC Hugh M. Hefner Moving Image Archive website. Well, onward now with this theme of history and stereotypes and accuracy and a mascot controversy in Orange County. Anaheim High School is home of the colonists. The mascot, chosen by students and teachers a century ago, is a man dressed in a traditional pilgrim outfit, towering over a capital A and leaning on a musket. Is it racist? Is it offensive? Problematic? Well, that's what the student body wrestled with all November, which, by the way, was Native American Heritage Month, and the majority decided it is not. Here to talk about this is an Anaheim High School graduate himself, Gustavo Arellano, columnist over at the LA Times. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
All right, so are you proud to be a columnist? Is there a cheer for that?
97 rules, man. Of course I am. Home of the colony, once a colonist, always a colonist. The great thing about being from Anaheim High is that when my aunts used to go there in the late 1960s, the student body was 95% white, and they were beat up all the time for being Mexican. By the time I went there 30 years later, the student body was overwhelmingly Mexican. We didn't pick on anyone. Instead, we basically, it was like a Archie comic style high school. There was Mexican stoners, Mexican geeks, all that good stuff. So very proud of my school.
All right. So give us the historic, you know, the accurate meaning behind the name. I mean, what colonists are we talking about here?
It specifically refers to the founding of what's now the city of Anaheim. It was a plot of land that was later on would be called the Mother Colony because, you know, there was Germans from San Francisco. German immigrants lived in San Francisco, created a vineyard, a winemaking colony, socialist, by the way, in around the 1850s. Then, you know, the vineyards went away. Then the orange trees started coming in. Then, of course, Anaheim grew up and became the city it became. So in 1921, that's when the student body decided, hey, we want to refer to that history of our founding fathers and mothers. And so we're going to call ourselves a mother colonist, but no athletic team I think ever in history would ever want to be called mothers, even though mothers are the toughest people on the planet. So they dropped the mother and they called themselves colonists.
But those who are advocating for a name switch say Anaheim is built on the ancestral land, right, of the Gabrielino and Tongva people. It wasn't completely unpopulated, right, when German settlers came and started that colony. What do you say to that?
Oh, yeah, no one's ever said that either. I mean, the Germans, they bought the land from a Mexican land grantee named Juan Pacifico Ontiveros, who he got the land from the Spaniards. We forget that that used to be Spanish land and Mexican land. And also, I mean, I totally sympathize with that argument, but if they want to go after an offensive mascot in that sense, they're picking the wrong Anaheim high schools. Just go down to Anaheim Hills where you have the Esperanza Aztecs, the Canyon High Comanches, and then, or better yet, just go up harbor and go to our longtime rival, the Fullerton Indians, which nowadays, especially the Indian name as a mascot, that's been long gone with most schools, but Fullerton still keeps it.
Yeah, I grew up in the South where Rebels, that's a big mascot all over
well,
the South.
There was a high school in Anaheim as well, the Savannah Rebels, and they specifically had the Confederate flag, and they finally dropped that only in the 1990s.
So instead of a school board shouting match, administrators over at Anaheim High turned this controversy into a 5-day civics lesson for the students there, and it all culminated in a vote. Was that the best way to do this, do you think?
I mean, it was better than making the students read Tess of the Duverville, you know? Shows how much I like that book. But it was interesting because they had an entire week devoted to it, and they gave the decision, they gave a vote to the student body. The student body, 75% of them said they wanted to keep the name, period, with the breakdown there being like about 40-some percent wanting to keep the name and the mascot, and about 30-some percent saying keep the name but drop that pilgrim mascot as well. So they don't have the final say, though. The Anaheim Union High School District Board of Trustees, they're going to take a vote on it sometime in December, and we'll see what happens there. But the student body and the super vast majority of alumni, they want to keep the colonist name.
I mean, and let's think about the mascot and the pilgrim outfit. I mean, again, if the idea was German or Prussian settlers that came in, where'd the pilgrim outfit come from?
Because,
I mean, come on.
Look, my sister, class of 99, by the way, homecoming queen, she told me years later that she always thought it was, she was also a cheerleader, so she always thought it was weird to see a Mexican kid dressed up as Miles Standish, you know? So no one really seems to be caring for that mascot anymore, but in a way I understand why it was created, because how do you draw a mascot of a German winemaking socialist? Like, that would be an amazing mascot, but that's probably not going to happen.
So what do you think is going to happen with the Board of Trustees when they do this next month? I mean, do you think anything will change?
Well, it'll be interesting because the people who have been pushing this, they really thought the students were going to be, you know, as woke as possible and vote it down. So they were not expecting because I've known about this campaign for over a decade. Friends of mine have been trying, who did not go to Anaheim, by the way, have been trying to push for this, to have the school drop the colonist name. So it remains to be seen. But I guarantee you that if the school board does drop the colonist name, there's going to be a lot of upset alumni. But what an interesting world that we live in, that the majority of these alumni are going to be Mexicans advocating for Germans that they have no relationship with and for a name that the like modern day society, you tell people, oh yeah, I graduated from Mannheim High, the colonists. They're like, what? That's crazy.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist and colonist from Mannheim High, an alumnus of Mannheim High, and of course a regular here at Greater LA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias. Go colonists.
That's it for today. We're online at kcrw.com/GLA with the latest episodes there. An easy way to subscribe to the podcast, too, and share your thoughts. kcrw.com/GLA. Tomorrow's episode, actor, comedian, and banjo player Steve Martin, who wrote and starred in a movie 30 years ago called LA Story. How does it hold up these days? And by the way, can electronic freeway signs really change your life? That's tomorrow. Catherine Barnes, Jackie Sedley, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Taw, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all piece the show together today. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thank you for your ears and time. Have a great night.